Welcome to the Lob Podcast, brought to you by Manscaped. Get 20% off Manscaped products when you use code TFT20.
Welcome to the Lob, your home of in-depth coverage and analysis by These Football Times, a movement of journalism you can trust. Each week, we endeavour to bring you the very best coverage of the game, exploring stories from the past and present with analysis by expert guests from around the world. Find more of our award-winning content online and in print. In the meantime, enjoy the podcast.
Hello and welcome to another edition of the Lob Podcast with These Football Times. My name is Stuart Horsfield, and I'm delighted to say it's another one of those episodes where we actually can't quite believe our luck as to who we're about to talk about. It's part centre circle, it's part celebrity, it's part ex-pro. It's got a little bit of everything, this one, so I'm not actually quite sure which category we're going to place it in, but I'll let Lewis and Gary deal with that bit. And talking of Gary, you're one of the co-hosts for this special edition.
I am indeed, yeah. I'm sitting here in sunny Spain with the sun streaming through the window. It's about 25, 26 degrees here. I'm going to talk to a guy who's put a player in the same patch of grass as, well, in my opinion, the best player ever to kick a ball in professional football, and many, many other stars as well. So basically, and we're going to talk about his book as well, and about his experiences. And he's a lad from Birmingham, so he's not very far from, I'm from Warsaw, so I'm not very far away from him. And I actually saw him play a couple of times as well.
And like I said, just sometimes, like you say, we get really lucky. I mean, we're always lucky with our guests, but just sometimes, like you say, we get really lucky. And I think once we get into the, well, we won't be name dropping, but we can name drop by proxy. Now, once we've spoken to him, we can name drop by proxy then that we've shared a screen with, someone who's shared a pitch with. It's one of them seven steps removed, isn't it? It's just like that.
It works for me, kiddo.
Second co-host, obviously somebody who definitely wouldn't want to miss this and was actually, again, I can't take much credit for anything really, but is the guy who sort of organised this sort of wonderful episode, Mr. Stephen Scragg. Stephen, welcome.
Oh, looking forward to this. I mean, same with Paul Power. When we spoke to Paul Power, I think we declared it to be the Panini special. You know, both you and I will have had this sticker, you know, on the playground, you know, swapped and changed, and yeah, we'd have collected this particular sticker many times.
It is, in fact, it is. You're right. This is Panini guest number two.
We could actually bracket these as their own kind of, like, you know, series, the Panini years.
Yeah. Maybe that's what we'll call them. We couldn't think. I couldn't think of a name at the beginning. So it takes us a couple of minutes. The Panini series. I won't ask if you're looking forward to it. Obviously, you set it up.
Massively, and as a kid, I'd have seen this player as well at Anfield in some wonderful football kits, particularly the sky blue hue. You know, polarizing kits, but I was always drawn to them, and I certainly had the Talbot one in the form of a Subutio team at one point.
And obviously we will mention the brown kit at some point, I'm sure, but we won't open with it. That's certainly not the most interesting thing we've got to chat about. Okay, so here we go. Today's guest, three-time soccer ball winner. Oh, I can't even say this. An MVP in Pelé's last professional game. Huge part of the legendary, and they were legendary, New York Cosmos. An England international and mainstay of a very vibrant Midlands football scene in the 70s and 80s. Inclusive, I've got to mention it, that chocolate brown Coventry away kit. Today we have the absolute pleasure of talking to the wonderful Steve Hunt about his amazing career and his fantastic book that is an absolute genius of a title, which is I'm With The Cosmos. Steve, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks for having me, guys.
Trust me, you, there is no thanks. I seem to say this all the time, but there is absolutely no thanks needed. The book is wonderful. Like I say, there's so much to talk about with regards to the football, your playing experience, what you experienced, who you played with, who you played against. And like I said, before we started recording, obviously, just a little bit about Studio 54. I'm sure just a little, any memories that you might have as you were in there. But we'll come to all of that. I guess we'll start at the beginning. We'll start at the beginning of your career. You know, as a youngster, as a junior, Villa, you know, all those sorts of things, you know, how you got involved you know, involved in the game. And in the book as well, I should mention as well, there's a great story about your mum. And your mum sticking up for your rights and the promises that were made to you as a young lad. And everybody needs a mum like that.
Oh, she's been brilliant, yeah. So my primary school was like 200-300 yards from Villa Park. So that's where it all started, played for the primary school when I was about 7, 8. Had a wonderful teacher there named Mr. Salt who just let us play and enjoy ourselves. So I've always had a ball at my foot, and that's how it started. From then it went to being selected for the local Aston boys, then Warwickshire boys, and eventually Villa scouted me and took me on when I was 11 years old, which was the old schoolboy forms then.
It's, I mean, we chatted, like Stephen said, we chatted with Paul Power a couple of weeks ago, and we were sort of talking about the importance of school and school football in the development of young players in your generation.
Yeah, without doubt. I mean, school was like a very important part of my football, what should we call it? Just put me on the road to everything. But I was very lucky because the school teachers I had throughout my schooling career were not pushy. They just, as I say, let you enjoy yourself, which I think is very important.
And I guess, you know, sort of coming to you, Gary, and again, you know, I know we seem to mention it, and I am really sorry. I always crops up and I apologise, Gary, but... You know, I guess, you know, you'll sort of be able to relate to, I mean, I suppose Stephen and I were just coming out, the importance of school sport, certainly school football, was just starting to sort of dwindle and was on the wane when we were sort of leaving school. But I guess, you know, you'll be able to relate to what Paul said and obviously what Steve's saying now about the importance of school football.
Yeah, when I was in junior school, we had what they laughingly called an all-weather pitch, which is one of these sort of red grass things that if you fell over, you tear your knee apart, and I mean that was bloody horrible. And they say it was all weather pitch. You could never play if it rained because you just used to help hold the water. It's like a swimming pool. But yeah, I mean, in senior school we played a lot more football, and in fact played a lot of sports. I mean, it's strange, and it was true. I mean, not just me. So I'm not in trouble here. There's probably, I don't know, 5 or 6 kids in the same situation who, once you were, you know, if you were sport orientated, you had a bit of sort of ability. You played for the cricket team, you played for the football team, you were in the cross country team, you know, you played the basketball team. So yeah, I mean, it did. And sport to me in school was such a big part of me, sort of, you know, falling in love with the genre. And, you know, as Steve says, it's important to have a teacher that inspires you. And I broke my leg when I was 13, just before we were due to go into the national basketball finals at the Albert Hall. Just annoyingly, but I had a teacher at my school, a guy called Pete Whittaker, who's probably passed on now, who sort of, you know, was sort of working me on rehabilitation, got me in touch with a physio at Walsall Football Club, a guy called Tom Martin, to help me get back onto the path. So, you know, not only for inspiration, but also when you sort of need that helping hand, key teacher is really important, as Steve says.
And I guess, Stephen, as well, you know, for us, when we, you know, when we were at school, sort of in, again, you know, we sort of go back to it, that sort of early 80s, mid 80s. When you're at school, and certainly when you're into sport and you're into football, and like Gary said, if you play for the football team, chances are you play for every team going. But anything was possible. You know, it seemed like any career was possible. I still think I could be a footballer. Obviously, it's clearly, it's starting to become a little bit more doubtful now. I am aware of that. But when
time's running out, Stu. Time's running out for us.
I'm just starting to accept that. But when you're at school, or when we were at school then, it just seemed like it was possible. Whereas I think now with the academies, you know, if you're not in the academy system, the chances are it's going to pass you by. But back then, there was always that hope that someone would see you play, whether it's for the school team or your Sunday league team, your Saturday team. There was always just that chance, that possibility that I don't think kids seem to have now.
Yes. You know, late 80s, I mean, I had trials at Wigan Athletic, who were probably the old third division at the time, you know, nowhere near the club that they would eventually become in an FA Cup winning capacity. But yes, it was, because, you know, you'd play school level football and there would be scouts would come along, especially for the cup competitions, your local cup competitions. Once you got to the business end of one of those, then, you know, it became serious stuff. I mean, I remember growing up and watching on World of Sport and Grandstand things like the Schoolboy Internationals and stuff like that. And these were all just kind of like, you know, relatable kids from kind of like my surroundings, you know, and this gave you that idea that anything was possible. And you're right, you know, once the academy system kicks in and players are identified, and we talk about Paul Power saying there was a 4-year-old at Manchester City and stuff like that, it's a completely different world now. You know, that, I mean, I'm sure it does still happen further down the divisions. You know, you look at a player like Jamie Vardy, for instance. You know, he still lived that kind of traditional dream of coming from non-league all the way up to being a Premier League winner and playing for England. So, you know, it can happen, but it feels now like if a player does that, it's like winning the lottery. It's a once in a blue moon type of thing. It's a once in a generation occurrence. Whereas before, I mean, as a Liverpool fan, you know, watching someone like Jimmy Case, who played for South Liverpool, he played for the Dockers teams and stuff like that. You know, Howard Gayle was turning out for kind of like the teams on a Sunday on a Saturday. And, you know, it was possible to gatecrash these rarefied airs, whereas now, you know, I think there's very little scope. It's proper eye of the needle territory to be able to do that.
Unfortunately so, which I think is probably why my chances are dwindling as well. I think the academy system has a lot to answer for my career as well, or lack of it at the moment. So, Steve, obviously, you know, it's Villa for you. You know, as a child, you know, you're sort of into their youth system, if you like. And obviously, you know, which brings you into contact with Ron Saunders. And like I said, the book's brilliant. You know, I read the book in two sittings. It was fascinating stuff. Especially being able to relate to the characters that I knew growing up, the players, the managers, you know, and sort of, I guess, Ron Saunders is a character that runs quite through your playing career. You know, you sort of, you know, you meet up with him again at Albion, but obviously he's there right at the beginning of your sort of formative career. And again, it's, you make a really good point about man management and the impact that can have, and certainly the impact it can have on young players. But Ron Saunders is always a character that's fascinated me, mainly because he was almost like a closed book, and I've probably learned more about him from reading your book than I have done in the last 30 years.
Yeah, can I just say before we go into that, you two got the haircuts for the 70s. I can't understand why you didn't get that apprenticeship.
I'll try anything. I will try anything.
Your haircut now.
You should see the flares I'm wearing.
Excellent stuff. Excellent. I'm taking that as a badge of honour.
Yeah, I am. Yeah, if I could have played for the Cosmo, I'm looking right there. But yeah, like I said, Ron Saunders, he is a character that absolutely fascinates me, because I know very little about him.
Yeah, I mean, when I first joined, it was Vic Crowe and Ron Wiley, and they didn't last long. But when I signed pro forms and that, it was Ron Saunders, and it was all discipline with Ron. I know players in the past have said, you know, they felt bullied, you know, as a youngster with him. It was just his way. Yes, I suppose it could be a form of bullying, but, you know, it was his way. And, if you know, and there was no advice coming from him. You know, that was left to the reserve team coach. And, you know, you just had to get yourself in the first team. Once you were there, he looked after you.
It's a great point you just made there, because, again, in the book, you know, if you were in the first 11, or if you weren't in the first 11, sorry, then he didn't want to know you. But in terms of, I guess, you know, you do mention it in the book, but in terms of learning from him, because I mean, there were some great players at that Villa side, you know, that eventually went on to win the European Cup, granted not under him, but the side that won the league. Do you think players did develop under Ron Saunders, or was it all very much about discipline and physicality? You know, do you think that they developed technically under him?
Oh, I think, yeah, of course they did. You know, they wouldn't have gone on to, and he put together a fantastic side that won the, you know, the English First Division as it was then, and then on to the European Cup. And so he must have developed them. It's like if you got injured. My first game as a pro, I signed on the Wednesday and I played on the Saturday and I'd done my cartilage, very first game. And I don't think he spoke to me for about 3 or 4 weeks. He never set foot into the treatment room. You know, that's what he was about. You know, it was the first team and getting success, getting fit. And he got his success through it.
I mean, obviously, Gary, you mentioned, you know, you were in the Midlands, or, you know, Walsall fan, but I guess, you know, what Ron Saunders did at Villa, I guess, put Midlands football on the map. And I suppose, you know, you've been a Walsall fan, that the perception that other fans of other clubs in the Midlands had of, you know, what sort of perception did they have of Ron Saunders?
You know, for an area rich in football clubs, the West Midlands have a dearth of success. And, you know, Villa winning the Football League and then the European Cup of the following year was so out of character for Midlands football at the time. So, yeah, I suppose, you know, therefore there must have been a lot of respect. I mean, it's difficult to say because, I mean, I wasn't a Villa fan, although I knew lots of Villa fans. You know, I used to go to, although I was I'm a Chelsea fan, I used to go to Warsaw regular. I did go to watch the Villa a few times and, you know, the Baggies and Birmingham. But, yeah, I mean, it's difficult not to have respect for a guy who you know, wins the championship with a team, with a club like the Villa. And, you know, as Steve said, he put together some really accomplished players. I mean, you know, Dennis Mortimer, Gary Shaw, Tony Morley, Des Bremner, often massively underrated, but such a key element in that side. And, you know, they were... and, you know, as you mentioned, he didn't sort of have the glory, shall we say, of coaching them to managing to the European Cup. But, you know, it, in all intents and purposes, it was his team that Tony Barton took over. And, you know, it's interesting to hear that what Steve said about, you know, if you weren't in the first team, you didn't want to know you, and if you're injured, this reminds me of Shanks a little bit. And Chris Lawley's tell the story that I think he said, I can't remember, Steve will put me right on this one. He sort of only missed 3 games in 3 years or something, and he was injured, and he was sort of walking past Shankly said, here comes the malingerer. You know, I mean, this is to the typical of Shank's humour, but, you know, I mean, I guess there's a certain logic you have to understand of football management, in as much as nobody's job is safe because their reserve team is doing well. It's the first team that the manager is judged on. Now, for right or wrong, I think that's just true. And, you know, when Saunders took Villa to the to win the Football League, you know, that's a pretty damn good achievement. You know, and if he did it by being a bit of a disciplinarian, as Steve alluded to, you know, that's the way it worked for him.
Steve and I, as a big Liverpool fan, you know, I guess you were sort of front, although obviously you'd be a lot younger, but front and centre of Villa's sort of impertinence, along with Nottingham Forest, to come along and sort of dare to take Liverpool's not only domestic titles but European titles as well. And, you know, and you'll have seen, you know, the likes of Clough, Ron Saunders, you know, like Gary said, there was Shankly at Liverpool. You had these sort of almost dictatorial figureheads at clubs who, you know, like as Gary said, and as Steve said, you know, first team is everything, and rightly so, because that's what keeps you in your job. But I guess you, as a Liverpool fan, you know, this sort of development of Villa almost comes from nowhere.
It does. And, you know, I come to football, you know, properly switch, it was always there, but, you know, I sit up and take notice from about 79, 80 onwards. That's my kind of like the penny dropping. And the teams that were relevant then were Nottingham Forest and then swiftly Aston Villa. You know, as a Liverpool fan, I've said it before, and you know, as daft as it sounds, Everton weren't particularly relevant at that point in time, nor were Manchester United. You know, the challenge came from the Midlands. It was Villa and it was Forest. And they were the teams that, you know, were on our radar domestically. You know, beyond that, you know, and for me, I had a lot of respect for those sides because, I don't know, I think it was instilled by my dad, is that side of me that is always a football fan as well. So, you know, I always had that appreciation for other teams and other players. And yes, that Villa side and that Forest side were, you know, played, and Ipswich were another one, you know, at that point in time as well, that were huge. Not the Midlands, but, you know, these were the teams that were omnipresent for me. The cup sides, like Tottenham were winning cups, but it didn't seem to quite have the same impact. You were either a league team that could challenge and win a league title, or you were a cup team. And the cup teams were kind of brushed off a little bit. So Manchester United and Tottenham were very much, I don't know, embossed as being cup teams, which left them at slightly less serious than an Aston Villa or Nottingham Forest at that point in time. And they were fine sides, and as you say, they were managed by what were basically football dictators, and that's the way they had to be. It's almost as if they seemed to engender some kind of cartoon character of themselves. There have been something that taken from their own personality and then amplified that for the circumstances that they were in for that football and landscape.
How can I explain it? You sort of entry into the game, Steve, I guess, was quite traditional at the time. You know, like you say, you were at Villa, you signed pro. It didn't necessarily work out with the first team manager who was there. But then what comes next is almost, it's in the book, but it must have come from absolutely nowhere. This offer to play in North America, you're still young, you're just at the beginning of your career. It just seems like a move that was either ahead of its time, or it just didn't seem to be where players would normally, maybe traditionally, go in order to develop the career. But, you know, and again, you know, you put it in the book that you wouldn't change it for the world. What you learned about work ethic, what you learned about the way to play the game, the way to train, the intensity with the players that you played against. But that moment that you sort of go in and that you've been informed that there's a guy in the canteen waiting to speak to you, how did that actually make you feel?
Well, it was a bombshell, because I'd only just got married. I married early to my first wife. Been married a month. I'd played in the quarterfinal of the League Cup the year that Villa won it. And I thought everything's hunky-dory. Bought myself a little house. Got myself a dog. I thought, right, I'm set up here. Nick Antin from New York that wants to take you over there, and I've agreed a fee. So it just hit me, you know. But I thought, if somebody's willing to let you go, I'll go and have a chat with this guy. And it turned out to be a fantastic guy called Joe Mallett. Wonderful guy. I think what did it, he said, you'll have some interesting teammates if you come join us. Because I didn't know they were playing, you know. And I said, well, who's your teammates? He said, well, one in particular you might like. It's by the name of Pelé. And I went, I'm sure I said to him, I mean, you mean the Pelé? I said, yeah, you got it. And I said, well, it didn't take long then. You know, one phone call to the missus, and I said, look, I've got the chance of playing with the best player this world's ever known. What do you think? I mean, we'd never been out of Birmingham, let alone going on a plane to, you know, which was then meeting up in Bermuda, would you believe? So it was a massive bombshell, but when I look back at it, it's quite unique, isn't it, you know, to get that opportunity.
Well, it's funny, because I was going to ask you that. I mean, and again, you know, nowadays there's players agents, there's advisors, there's so much goes on around a player now before any decisions are made. But did you seek advice, but was it just, here's the offer, you make the phone call to your wife, and then you just make the decision? Was it literally, I'm not saying as simple as that, but is that literally the sort of mechanism that you went through on making your decision?
I did, yeah. I, you know, as I say, it was a shock. But what I did do, obviously, I rang to see if the wife would be all right moving abroad. But rang around family and friends. I said, look, I'm off. I'm going. I'd made my mind up. The opportunity to play with this guy, plus others, was too good to miss. So, you know, it was a very exciting time. It was like a whirlwind. Within, I don't know, 10 days, 2 weeks, I was on the plane.
Gary, like you say, I mean, you know, cause we can obviously all see each other on the screen and stuff, shaking your head, but it, I mean, obviously, we're listening to Steve chat about it. It didn't even happen to us. But to go into a canteen and be like, do you want to come play for us? And by the way, you'll be playing with Pelé. And again, I think what needs to remember is the age as well. This isn't a sort of a, you know, obviously, some of the players that were in the Cosmos were coming to the end of the career, but Steve's not. Steve's at the start of his career. It's, you know, it's a big, you know, it, like we say, the game's moved on so much. You know, New York must have felt like, well, like we say, like a different world. It was such a big thing for one so young and at the start of a career as well.
Yeah, I mean, it's seeing Steve explaining how he felt when this guy says, you know, oh, Pelé, you know, you think I'll swim the bloody Atlantic to get to play with Pelé, then why catch a plane to Bermuda, which, you know, ain't no bad way to get across the Atlantic and land in Bermuda. I mean, I'm old enough to remember, you know, when the Cosmos were in the height, and I remember Steve being over there, because obviously it was a big thing, it publicised massively. And I'm sure Steve went this the wrong way, but I remember he said this English guy, Steve, who's it? Pelé, you know. I went to ask Steve, if you don't mind, Steve, just did you ever feel that you think either A, this is a dream, this isn't true, or did you ever feel that I'm going to get rumbled here and I'm going to get found out? Did you ever feel that? Because, I mean, it must have been, as Stu says, you know, this is a young guy at the start of his career. You know, it's not as if you're sort of, you know, been, you know, 28, 29 with 60 caps, international caps behind you, an established world star. I mean, how did you feel? But
when I went over on that plane, I was thinking, am I going to be good enough? You know, how can I, you know, having played, what, 7 first-team appearances, get the opportunity to play alongside this great man? And, yeah, you know, I was very, very nervous about it all. But I literally had to hit the ground running and just do what I could, you know, just show some resilience. You know, it's just like meeting a guy down the pub, you know, he's just like a smashing guy to meet. So he put me at ease, and the training was very laid back, very, we say, Brazilian style. So it's all new culture for me. But yeah, I mean, I didn't know if I was going to be good enough to play alongside him.
It's interesting. I mean, I guess you sort of, you know, what you said there just portrays you have the right sort of attitude, the right sort of demeanor about yourself just to make it work, rather than thinking, you know, I've landed, here I am, I'm big time child, there's me and Pelle, here's my mate Pelle. So you had that attitude to make it work, and you know, fair play, buddy, you know, you go out there and not only sort of become part of it, but a star there as well. It's a massive, massive boost to the, massive boost for English football, but to have, you know, somebody, you know, seven first team games behind you, and you're playing, you know, in North America with lots of Pelle and others following up, Beckenbauer, you know, Carlos Alberto and Schenaglia. I mean, you know, well done, buddy. I mean, you know, you live the dream. Every young footballer's live the dream, buddy. I mean, fantastic guys.
You know, coming to you, Stephen. Again, it's one of those where you almost, if it wasn't true, you wouldn't believe it. Which I know sounds like a daft statement. But you know, if someone wrote a book, if someone proposed a story where a young English lad from the Midlands, you know, like you say, seven first team games, and then a club from America where it's all just starting, they're trying to grow the game, develop the game. The greatest player who's ever played the game is going to be there. He'll be joined by, you know, an iconic player who's going to win the World Cup as a player and as a manager. He's also going to be there, and this young lad's going to be picked up and just plonked in the middle of all this. You'd be like, yeah, but it's no one's going to go to the cinema and believe this story. But that is the story, isn't it? That is ultimately the story, and it obviously is, you know, it forms a large part of Steve's book, but that's the story that unfolded at the time.
Yeah, and Steve was one of you know, a number of British players that made that same trip over there. You know, a couple of Liverpool reserves, Max Thompson and Kevin Cooley, did the same. It was Toronto Blizzard or somewhere like that they went to. So you had these younger players that were being picked up to supplement these star players in these you know, iconically named teams in the NASL, which was just this, I don't know, amazingly kind of like shiny product. I mean, I remember the World of Sport in particular would show a load of NASL games. And we'd watch them, and then we'd go out and recreate kind of, particularly the penalties, you know, the countdown clock and the you know, the running from kind of like halfway down the street to have 10 seconds to kind of like put the ball past the keeper. You know, it really caught the imagination. The interesting thing is that a lot of those younger players that went, many of them stayed. You know, they thrived over there in the way that they got into coaching, they got jobs in colleges, universities, and there's many of them that are still out there now. Steve's one of a very small number of players that went over there and kind of made their name over there and then came back. It's a bit like kind of like the band, like Bush. There was a band called Bush who were very little known in the UK, yet went stratospheric in America and then came back and tried to do the same over there. And there was this type of element to players like Steve. The only other one I can think of off the top of my head is Peter Beardsley, who went and played for Vancouver Whitecaps. He was at Carlisle, went over to Vancouver, played for them, came back, you know, Manchester United for a very short period of time, played about half a game for them, but then thrived at Newcastle and went on to like huge things. There's not many that went and did that career in reverse like Steve did, and I think they stand out like a beacon as part of this, because on one side of it you've got, yes, the Pelés and the Beckenbauers, Cruyff went and played over there, but then you've got Steve who kind of like put and taken over as a kid, did so well that suddenly kind of like they were watching from this side saying, well, we want him to come and do it for us.
I'm just jumping in for a second there, Steve. Another guy went over there. I don't know if it was the same sort of era that Steve remembers, was Ray Hudson, who played for Newcastle. I think he went over to Earthquake or something like that, or I'm somewhere in Florida. Fort Lauderdale, correct, mate. I spoke to Ray about the Dutch book I'm writing, because he played alongside Jan van Beveren for a while, and he said he helped him there. But there's another guy who's really made a success over there, and he's just been signed by Beckham to do the in-game comments at Inter Miami. But he's got there's a radio show, a national radio show there, and also a lot of commentary. Another guy who's not a star at Newcastle went over there, and I think he was captain of the Football Dale for a while as well. and played with Wolves to Horse.
Yeah.
You said some people stay over there and race place and did that.
I mean, we'll come to the players in a minute, Steve. Obviously, like I said, the players that you played with and played against. But before then, like I said, the title of the book is I'm with the Cosmos, and you refer to this phrase as being able to get yourself pretty much anything you want at that time. If you sort of use that, if you use that phrase, it didn't help me last night when I'm with my team. But other than that, I'm talking with the guy who was with the Cosmos tomorrow. Didn't cut any ice at home. But anyway, but with regards to, you know, what was it like at the time? Because obviously, like, you know, the NSL was starting to take off. They were trying to sort of implement or try and promote football in America. And obviously, the Cosmos at the time were the sort of the big side, the side that everyone knew. Obviously, with Pelé being there as well. But what was it actually like being in the Cosmos bubble?
So I must admit, like, there was lots of ups and downs. I mean, when we first arrived, we were stuck out in the sticks. We had no transport, so I was feeling a little bit lost at one stage. But as soon as the game started and the training, and I realised what I was part of, things just took off. I mean, that season was the season everything really exploded. So it was great timing. We were only averaging 15, 20,000 at the most at the beginning of the season. And towards the end, we were selling out every game 80,000. So it was a fantastic time to be there because everything just clicked. And obviously, we had terrific backers in Warner Brothers who opened many doors. It was just great. I mean, for a 20-year-old, you know, just married, some of the experiences when we got dropped off in New York were, you know, a little bit airy, shall we say. You know, getting dropped off by taxi drivers in the wrong part of town wasn't great. But, you know, I've always been willing to learn, both on and off the pitch. And as I say, it was just showing a bit of resilience, proving that I could play alongside these people and improve. And I did because, I was willing to listen and learn off them.
I've got to ask as well. Like I said, one of the questions we're dying to ask. Studio 54. Can you remember going? I suppose is the first question. And if you can, what was it like?
I do remember going. I thought I've got to see this place. Everybody's going on about it. I'm not one to use that phrase "on with the Cosmos" very often. You know, a few of the lads abuse it quite a lot, but I'm a bit more laid back. I thought, I've got to try it. So, you know, I did skip the queue at Studio 54. My biggest worry was I didn't know what to wear. You know, I had the long hair like you guys have still got. The very embassy of that. But I thought, well, what are we going to wear? You know, the people going in there with makeup on and things like that. You know, this is guys. And it was just, dare I say, like a freak show. The line to go in there, and I've walked to the front, you know, with my usual clobber, and said, "I'm with the Cosmos," and they went, "Great, in you go." So that was good. I enjoyed that. But I remember it was just this magical place that once you walk through the doors, what I did, I headed upstairs to the viewing point just to have a look, see what was going on downstairs, you know, keep out of the way, usual. I saw this, she must have been 80, 90-year-old lady on her own, not with anybody else, just on her own, really freaking out to the music, you know. And I mean, she's obviously obviously on something to keep her going at that age, but she never stopped all night. And that was my biggest standout. That I thought, how's this lady doing it, you know, at this age? But the people in there, it was weird, but it was just a great experience. I only went a couple of times. It wasn't my kind of music, mate.
Brilliant. So obviously, we're here to talk about the football, but I just needed to know. You're the only person I've ever met who's ever been, so I've got to live my life vicariously through somebody. So once you got into training then, and obviously you're faced with, you know, Pelé's there. And I mean, Gary will definitely want to like talk about and hear the stories about Pelé. But, you know, and again, it's in the book, you know, you talk about the pink and the pale yellow suits that he wore and all the things. But what was he like? What is he like?
As I say, when I first met him, I was very nervous. He's one of these kind of guys that he's very laid back himself. He's got this huge smile. I mean, you know, I'm sure you've seen him many times, but he's always smiling and greeting people and willing to put himself out, always available for the autographs, things like that. But he's just a genuinely nice guy, you know. I can't say any more than that about him. I mean, obviously, his football speaks for itself, but off the pitch, he had time for everybody. He certainly wasn't a Ron Saunders that didn't talk to you if you weren't in the first team. You know, he'd speak to any of the young lads that were in the reserves and that. He had time for everybody. But yeah, he had standout suits. He really did have standout suits. Only he could get away. It was from like out of Miami Vice, I think.
Gary, you know, I think I'm right in saying for you, probably the greatest player that's ever played the game. And again, you know, here's this, you know, Steve is 20 years old and all of a sudden his formative footballing years are going to be, or some of his formative footballing years are going to be with the greatest player who's ever played the game. It's a priceless, priceless experience and opportunity.
Yeah. I celebrate the fact of when I was born, when I was, that, you know, I've seen some fantastic players play football over the years. But for me, Pelé is the one that, you know, on the biggest stage, he did the best things on the biggest stage. And, you know, some of the things, you know, like in the 70 World Cup, and not so much the goals, but the trying to chip the Czechoslovakian goalkeeper in the halfway line, and the most extravagant dummy you've ever seen in your life when he stepped over the ball against Mazzukic, the Uruguayan goalkeeper, and just proved he was human by rolling the ball past the far post rather into the union bag. And, you know, I mean, you know, if you want to have a player to sort of play alongside and learn from, and not only learn from how to play, but the dedication to the game and training, you know, Steve mentioned there, and a love of the ball, you know, and a love of playing the game and a passion for it. And, you know, I suppose you couldn't have a better teacher. Teacher is probably the wrong word, but you couldn't have a better mentor, a better colleague, a better teammate, especially if the guy, I mean, and, you know, I mean, obviously, pictures of Pelé, I've never seen him in real life, but I love met the guy. And as Steve says, if he's such a nice guy, Steve relates, I mean, that can only be the cherry on the top of the cake to have, you know, be played alongside that. And, you know, and then afterwards, you know, you talk about being spoiled, you know, Carlos Alberto, Beckenbauer. I mean, you know, it's like having all your Easter eggs on one day, isn't it?
And I guess that's it, Stephen, isn't it? I mean, you know, if, like, you know, we talk all the time about, you know, players, and we talk about the history of the game and the past and all of those things, but I guess it doesn't matter where it is, where the club was, what league it was, whether it was in its formative years, whether Pelé was at the end of his career, whether Beckenbauer was, all of that doesn't really matter. It's the opportunity to play alongside and learn from, and, you know, and Steve just talked about this in his book, you know, just learn from what it takes to almost achieve greatness, which I think is something that comes across in the book about the difference between the likes of Carlos Alberto, Pelé, Beckenbauer, you know, what they brought every day to the football club, regardless of whether it was the end of the career, regardless of whether it was in North America, that didn't matter. So I guess the learning experience was just as good whether those players had been in the prime or not.
Oh, completely. So it must have been a complete education, you know, to be able to just view them in training, let alone be kind of like, you know, imparted with the knowledge that they had. Must have been absolutely incredible. And the fact that it was within an environment in New York, you know, such a, you know, a vibrant place, you know, the probably the greatest city on the face of the planet, I'm sure many people will probably rate it as. So yes, on one side, you've got kind of like the, you know, learning through life in general, you know, Studio 54, you know, dropped off in the wrong part of town, all of that, you know, an amazing kind of like education of life, and then an education of football as well. You know, to have been, you know, it must have been like being a sponge and just taking all of this in. You know, and the fact that, you know, the NASL as well, very unique in its construction, was that it never played on tradition. It just, you know, it was what it was, and it was shameless about it. And I think that was the great thing as part of this, is that A, you've got the players that Steve's surrounded by, B, you've got the style of the league, what it is, and then the location. You know, it's absolutely astronomical. You know, it's got to be one of the greatest, you know, opportunities to be handed to a player in the entire history of the sport.
Just put the formats to, just ask Steve about this. I wrote an article a while ago about Vancouver Whitecaps when Tony Waiters was manager there and they won the soccer bowl. And it's crazy whether they play the two-legged game. So aggregate doesn't matter. So you can win 8-0 and lose 1-0, and it counts as a win each. And even if the second game is a draw, then they play extra time. And then, because the Americans have this morbid fear of a draw in any sport, and then they play the penalty shootout. And then if the other guys win the penalty shootout, then they play a mini game at the end of that. So you could end up playing, you know, I mean, winning 8-0, drawing 0-0 return, playing this extra game on penalties, losing on penalties or the penalty shootout, the run from halfway line, and then have to play an extra mini game at the end. I mean, it must be a baffling state for a guy, you know, used to brought up on English football.
Funny enough, Ray Hudson, when he was playing for Lauderdale, we played, I think it was the quarterfinals, and we beat them in New York 8-3. We went away and we drew. So we had to have that mini game, which we drew. So then we had to have a shootout. So, you know, you're starting off at 7 o'clock kickoff and you're getting home at like 3 in the morning. By the time you finish all these. But yeah, it is the fear of a draw. They don't like a draw in America at that particular time.
Yeah, amazing. Sorry, Steve.
No, it's fine. Don't worry. I mean, like I say, obviously, you know, I'm sure we could talk about, you know, Pelé and yourself all day. But, you know, some of the other players, and one of the players, and Gary mentioned him earlier, Shanaglia, he's sort of a player that you talk about quite a lot in the book, and it, you know, your sort of your relationship with him and probably more his personality and his character seems almost quite a contrast to sort of what, you know, the laid back approach that Pelé has. You almost have these two contradictions almost playing in the same team.
Oh well, George thought he was the star, you know, above Pelé. and in some ways he proved it, you know. He was the best goal scorer I've ever played with. I mean, he was phenomenal, but he did have the ego to go with it, you know. And we ended up fighting within a month. I was only there a month and I'd had a fight with him on the training pitch because I called him lazy, and cut a long story short, he took me aside after we had a few punches. You've been brought over here I rely on you to feed me to score goals, full stop, nothing else. And then walked off. And so I did.
I guess, like I say, I mean, it must have been, and I think again, it, you know, something you talk about in the book, and you know, you sort of how does a manager not only bring together what is a relatively new side, a new concept in North America, but so many different footballing cultures, so many personalities, so many egos, you know, and you know, you talk about Ron Saunders as a manager, but in order to be able to manage that side and all of those players from all those countries, It must have been a nightmare.
Well, the language barrier as well. You know, there was so many different languages being spoken, and I gave up in the end because they couldn't understand my Brummie. So, look, when you cross the white line, language goes out the window. You know, if you can play the game and we're gelled like we did. I mean, when Franz joined and then ultimately Carlos, we just took off. We were just, I wouldn't say unbeatable, but we really did take off. Them two, as they would in any team, wouldn't they? Let's be honest. You've already got the world's greatest player, and then you get Franz Beckenbauer and Carlos Alberto, two World Cup winning captains. So great guys in their own right. God, I was lucky, wasn't I?
Yeah. Yeah. And it's funny because obviously, you know, again, in the book, you talk about how your mum had a soft spot for Beckenbauer and how he couldn't do enough for her. But again, I mean, obviously, it's highly unlikely that Beckenbauer or Pelé are going to come on this podcast. So unfortunately, you're the next best that we've got in terms of what they're like. But Beckenbauer, and again, you mention it about the, you know, the whether or not the third goal crossed the line in the World Cup final. And but again, you know, was he someone? Did you learn different things from these players? So yeah, Pelé, Carlos Alberto, Shanaglia, Beckenbauer. Did you learn different things for them, or did you find that actually all of them had common traits?
Yeah, the one thing that they've all got is they're the ultimate professionals. I mean, 100% dedicated, whether they were at the beginning of the career or the end of the career, you know. One thing I learnt off them is how they performed on the pitch, but also how they put themselves about off the pitch as well. You know, for the US cause, if you like, they wanted to get the kids playing. They wanted it to take off. So they were great for that. The one thing that really stuck out to me with these great players was, you know, you see like training sessions and players are doing all these fancy flicks, like this freestyling stuff they do, and I never saw them do it once. Saw some of the reserve lads and the other players that were good players, but never. It was always about the basics, doing 10 out of 10, you know, passing to feet, the movement, the control. It was all about the basics with them, and they did it better than anybody. But you never see them do these, you know, catch it on the back of the neck, flicking it up, around the world, all that. No, it was just like they were 100% professionally going about their job getting the basics right.
I guess, you know, Stephen, you know, we've mentioned, you know, a couple of times on different podcasts about the NASL and why it didn't take off and, you know, for the various reasons. But, you know, I'm not going to say it wasn't for the want of trying, but it wasn't for the want of investment. It wasn't for the attraction of great players. I guess it just, at that time around, the game, or maybe America, North America wasn't ready for the game at that point.
It went into fashion, didn't it? It went into fashion, it fell out of fashion. You know, it was the classic case of boom and then bust. You know, I think it's Rick Wakeman who said he poured a load of money into it, lost an absolute fortune, but had a ball doing it. You know, and I think that says everything about the NASL. When the people who lost money hand over fist smile about doing it. You know, I think that's one of the biggest telltale signs there, is that they just had the time of their life, you know, being involved in it, whether that was as an administrator. I'm lucky enough to talk to Clive Toy, who had such a massive role in the NASL, and he's just kind of like, you know, you set him off on the NASL, and you know, it all pours out, you know, the good, the bad, but at the end of it, he just say, you know, you wouldn't change it for the world. You know, he wouldn't want it to be any different. It's that concept that, you know, it got on the wrong side of FIFA as well. It was, you know, along with the Colombian league, which we spoke about on a different podcast not so long ago, you know, it's the greatest renegade league, you know, there's ever been. And, you know, I think football is richer for the existence of teams like the New York Cosmos. I mean, all the names are just, I mean, I've still got a Tampa Bay Rowdy shirt from kind of like knocking around. You know, it's just all the names are kind of like iconic, but for reasons that aren't very usual with football. You know, the icons of the games are the kind of like the biggest names in football. It's the Real Madrid, it's the Barcelona, it's the, you know, it's the teams with pedigree and all that. But then here's this, you know, edifice of kind of like everything that was, you know, the difference about football, and then putting a different hat on it. And it was a glorious thing, because it just attracted so much interest, but albeit a short period of time, it was an absolutely wondrous thing. And it shouldn't be. But that's the great thing about it. It did everything wrong, but it was so right.
Well, I guess from there, then we'll link that right into a return to the Midlands and back to literally going back to, not sent to Coventry, but back to Coventry. Obviously, you know, and again, it comes through in the book, Steve, that, you know, you're a Midlands boy. Was it just that, you know, that Coventry were the side? You know, were you prepared to go elsewhere, or were you wanting to go back? You know, because again, you mentioned the book about being homesick at times, but was it the Midlands? Was it a Midlands club that you wanted to go to?
Well, obviously, I preferred a Midlands club, yeah, but it was just that nagging feeling in the back of my mind that I hadn't proven myself in England, and yeah, the Cosmos threw quite a bit of money at me, but I was adamant that I wanted to prove myself back home, and I always had an ambition that I wanted to play for England, and playing in America, that would never have happened. But I did two seasons straight off with the Cosmos, and Gordon Milne, Coventry manager, came over with Ron Wiley, who played a big part in my career from beginning to end. And I saw him in the tunnel of one of the games before we were about to play. And I said, "Steve, we've come to see you play. I'm thinking of signing you." And I said, "Well, you might as well get the next flight back, because I'm suspended." So they flew across the Atlantic, not knowing that I was suspended. So they didn't get to see me. So perhaps I was fortunate as well, because they said they'd still take me anyway.
I suppose it's different, isn't it? If you're in the canteen in New York and you've got a guy from Coventry coming to chat to you, than when you're in Villa and you've got a guy from New York coming to chat to you. Gary, again, I suppose it, you know, it speaks volumes, you know, for Steve as a player, in that desire to play for England. You know, like we say, you know, you're in this almost perfect environment, learning from the greatest players that've ever played the game in a new country. But yet that desire and that will to prove yourself in the English game, that will and desire to win those England caps, you know, sort of supersede all of that. And it, I suppose it's a sign of character. And unfortunately, I'm not saying it doesn't exist in footballers these days, but I'm not sure how many others would maybe do it.
I'm not sure I would. I guess, you know, you're right. And yeah, I mean, I'm only kidding. I mean, I couldn't put myself in that position, so I couldn't say. But, you know, it's great credit that, you know, he was a guy who's making a strong living, building a career. in a foreign country, making lots of money, playing with world stars, but has this hunger to go back to prove himself in his native country and you know, and pursue an England international cap. So yeah, it's a great credit. And you know, read the book. It's not sort of, Steve says, you know, people might say, oh, did you ever regret it? Well, apparently no, he didn't, because of the things that success they had in England. But it must have been it must have been tempting to stay in America, and it must take some persuading. I'm not first, I'm not sure Coventry would be, Studio 54 for, Brent's Corner Bar in Highfield Road. So
I suppose, and Stephen, the journey from Villa to Coventry, it's almost a mirrored journey that Steve comes back on, that goes from New York to Coventry. I suppose the player that leaves to go to New York is completely different to the player who comes back to the Midlands and comes to Coventry.
Oh, I'm sure. Go out as a kid, come back as a man. Surely that's got to be the case. But yeah, totally get the concept of coming back to prove himself. And Coventry were probably the perfect club to be able to do that. The pressure, maybe not quite so much as it would have been at Villa, going back to a Villa at that point in time, maybe. A team that were always inclined to try and play good football. Gordon Milne, Liverpool player in the 60s, part of Shankly's side. He did absolutely wonderfully for himself. There was a point in time when, after Alf Ramsey had been sacked as the England manager and Joe Mercer had the job, an alternative option was that Mercer got the job alongside a younger assistant, and Milne was potentially that man. He went on to do his own odyssey by going coaching in Turkey, massively successfully as well. So I'd be interested to know how Gordon Milne came across, and were there any common themes there? Because Milne's adventure overseas was to come, whereas yours had already happened.
He wasn't a shouting and a baller. It wasn't all discipline. He was a nice guy, but he showed his discipline when it was needed. And he did try and play attractive football. I mean, at one stage, we were playing two out-and-out wingers, myself and Tommy Hutchinson. So we were a bit gung-ho, shall we say, to begin with. And I found it difficult, the transition from the American style to the English First Division. And I was in and out the team to start with. And eventually, when I made a move into midfield, that's kind of what started my career, and give it a kick up the backside that I needed when I moved into midfield.
You talk about, Dave Sexton in the book as well, and I guess it's sort of almost conversely with how you speak about Ron Saunders. You can talk about his eccentricities at times. But in terms of, as a manager, what are your thoughts, perceptions of, Dave Sexton, and again, the impact that he had on your career?
The thing with Dave, he was a football nut. He just loved the game. And what he was great at was not only the managing side of it, he was a very, very good coach. And some of his coaching, was some of the best I'd had. Again, another nice guy, not a shouter and baller, but you didn't want to cross him, put it that way. He had a boxing background as well. So you knew the discipline side. But footballing wise, he was a fantastic coach. And again, it was another one of those coaches that like to play the style of football that I like to play. So it was good times with both those managers.
There is sort of a return to the cosmos, and I don't want to dwell on that too much, because I've found out all the information I need to find out about Studio 54. I don't need to go back there anymore. However, and I know Gary, I'm sure Gary will be interested, but obviously, just in case you hadn't played or taken to the field with enough world-class iconic players, you then end up with Johan Cruyff, a game at Stamford Bridge. What, again, all I've got, Gary will probably have more questions than me, but all I've got is, what was it like?
Well, a complete surprise, because they didn't tell me he was playing. They go on a tour around, a bit like the Harlem Globetrotters. At the end of the season, they're off all around, doing exhibition games, and they happened to be playing at Stamford Bridge, and rang me up and said, do I fancy playing? So, of course I did. But when I went in the dressing room, I was getting changed next to Johan Cruyff. I thought, this is never ending. He was absolutely brilliant. Another one of these guys, that made you feel at ease, and of course, easy to play with. He played just inside me. I don't know. As I said earlier, I'm so fortunate looking back when I was on the pitch with all these great players.
Gary, I guess you'll have a question or two about Johan Cruyff and your sort of feelings about him as a player.
Yeah, well, you've gone from best player ever to the best player I've ever seen in real life. But just going to flip back a little bit to Coventry, because there's a game that Steve mentions in the book that I was actually there when Coventry went to the Baggies and they wore that brown strip and they lost seven goals or 7-0 or 7-1. And I've got a friend who was a Baggies fan. We used to go up there pretty regular, and that was obviously an entertaining team as well. And it was almost the scoreline was a bit weird, really, in as much as there were Coventry were never 7 goals behind Baggies, but they had there were two attacking teams, and one team and you put the ball in the net a lot of times, and then one team put in the back of it less times. But a fantastic game of entertaining football. But yeah, Cruyff, now here we go. I'm sort of in my muscle element here. Obviously you mentioned about Pelé and the things you learned from him. And playing one game with Cruyff obviously is different to playing a season with Pelé. But, you know, Cruyff has this reputation of being awkward and, you know, he could start an argument in a phone box. But from what you say, that's perhaps not the truth. And a lot of players I've spoken to and commentators in Holland I've spoken to say the image of Cruyff isn't really what the guy was like.
Well, I mean, I was only with him briefly. But certainly, what I my memories of him, he was a great guy, lovely guy.
I mean, you want your heroes to be nice guys as well, and you know, it's great to hear that somebody who's sort of first hand knowledge has sort of confirmed that. And you know, I'm going to ask you the impossible question there, Steve. Pelé or Cruyff? Not who's the best player, but who would you prefer to play with?
Oh my word! Well, Pelé. Obviously, I think just the name itself, you know, there's something about magical about that name, isn't it? Yeah. I learned off both of them. It was only the one game with Johan Cruyff, but he brought different dimensions. You know, his speed, his step overs, the legendary Cruyff turn. So it's hard to choose, really. If you could roll them all up into one player.
I guess, Stephen, you know, this sort of film or this story that's so unrealistic, I guess if we decide to make a second part to this film, this unbelievable film, and all of a sudden Johan Cruyff is in the sequel, you know, like Steve said there, you're in a changing room, or first of all, as a kid, you've gone to play in North America with Pelé, then Beckenbauer's turned up, Carlos Alberto's turned up, and that, okay, then you come back to Coventry, but then all of a sudden you find yourself in a Stamford Bridge changing room, and all of a sudden you're next to Johan Cruyff. The writers are just going to throw the story out. It's almost like all the luck that could possibly happen, or maybe not so luck, but hard work as well, but certainly all the good fortune that could happen has all just ended up on one person's plate.
The way it comes across is kind of like a football version of Cannonball Run.
Yeah.
You know, it's just like, my God, there's Roger Moore. There's Sammy Davis Jr. Hang on a minute, Steve Martin. No, it's Jackie Chan. It's kind of like one stellar name after another, after another, after another, and then, you know, does that become, you know, is there any point that becomes, you know, a normal day's work?
It's, and I guess, Stephen, obviously we don't want to bring the story down because it's such a great story, but then you go to Albion and obviously Ron Saunders is there, this sort of, almost, well, we call them Dick Dastardly's in another podcast series, the people who are sort of the sort of villains of the piece, and you know, and sort of his first comments, you know, already sort of set the scene that you're on your way out of, not on your way out of Albion, but you don't think it's appropriate for you to sort of stay there. And I guess like you say, how did it make you feel, you know, all those experiences, you play with all those great players, and yet here was a manager who wasn't prepared to either wait and see or see how you develop, see what sort of a player you'd become. Because, like, you know, as we've spent the last hour chatting about already, you know, your footballing career and experiences were so unique. You would like to have thought that he would have wanted to look at what you'd become as a player.
Yes, that's true. I mean, obviously, when I joined, it was Johnny Giles who was manager, and we had Johnny Giles, Norman Hunter, and Nobby Stiles. That was the management. So we could look after ourselves, put it that way. And I had a terrific time under those three. But of course, 2 years down the line, yes, Mr. Saunders turns up. And look, some managers like players, don't like others. And it's the same with players, you know. that can get on with some managers, but not with others. And Ron obviously didn't fancy me. I definitely didn't fancy him. So it was inevitable that I would be moving on. It was a bit of a wrench because I was enjoying my time at West Brom.
Yeah, and again, like you said, that comes across in the book. I know you mentioned about, you know, the guys who were there when you first got there, and you talked about whose side you wanted to be on in the five sides in training. And I suppose if ever there's going to be a contrast between Franz Beckenbauer, then I guess you had it at Albion.
Yeah, well, I mean, it was very much five-a-side orientated at West Brom under those three. And they picked captains each day, and you picked your teams. And the first three picked were Johnny, Norman and Nobby, because you just didn't want to get kicked up in the air by them. So they were always the first three picked. And that was the management team, you know, didn't mind the players.
And I guess, you know, again, Gary, you know, you'll have sort of lived through this era. You know, it's Midland, it's Midlands football. You know, like you say, you went to the Hawthorns. So you will have almost sort of been, obviously not in New York, but you'll have sort of had a front row seat, if you like, to Steve's career.
Just interesting about the Baggies, time of the Baggies. I mean, Giles' team were a joy to watch. They were entertaining. They played nice football. And I wouldn't say Saunders was the polar opposite, but he wasn't far off. His approach to football was very different to the style that Johnny Giles' team played. And yeah, I mean, I don't know how many times I've seen Steve play, but it must have been a couple of dozen at least, I guess, across the different teams he played in the Midlands, less so Coventry, but certainly the Baggers and the Villa. And it's interesting when you look back at the team Steve played for, and you know, aside from, you know, when Villa was sort of on the rise a bit, you know, at difficult times, at clubs that were experiencing difficult times, shall we say, and yet, you know, this guy still shone through and was rewarded with the England caps.
And I want to come on to the England caps in just a second, actually, because obviously that's a good positive to finish on as well, rather than obviously injury and that sort of thing. So, but just before that, Stephen, I think, like I say, apart from obviously the incredible high and success that Steve has in New York, another thing that sort of comes through in the story of Steve's career is an incredibly talented player who plays for in struggling teams and yet somehow manages still to shine, you know, when he talks about constantly being in relegation battles, but yet that sort of quality, you know, and there was never, I'm not saying there was never a move or the chance to move, you know, there may well have been, you know, move to some of the bigger clubs, but I guess it's a testimony again to someone's career and ability, not only to sort of help keep those clubs in the first division, but to then go on and still win those international caps at clubs that were not, should we say, not very glamorous to say the least.
Yeah, you know, it takes a very special player to be able to break into the international fold from what you would describe as being an unfashionable club as such. You know, hovering around mid-table or battling out for relegation to avoid relegation. It's that added bit of talent that makes the difference. And it's also having the bravery to do that for teams down there. It's easy to go pragmatic and to try and kick your way out of trouble, but to try and play your way out of trouble, there's something massively admirable about it. And I always, you know, was always quite, you know, eager to see Coventry, you know, teams like Coventry survive. You know, yeah, as a Liverpool fan, obviously we were always at the top, towards the top of the table, especially at that point in time. But, you know, across the broader spectrum of the division, you'd always be keeping an eye on what was going, who was about to go, who was going to survive or not. And there were certain teams that you were pleased to see the back of, and certain teams that you were pleased to see stave off the drop. And Coventry and West Brom and teams like that were definitely those type of teams that you were always, you know, silently, at least mutedly, kind of pleased that they've done it again and they've survived to fight another season. And it was down to that leap of faith and that bit of bravery and having a player who had that added bit of talent like Steve did.
I want to talk to you about England as well. Steve, and you know, like you say, that innate desire to represent your country and win those caps, you know, and you do it at Hampden, you know, Hampden Park, which, you know, again in the book, the atmosphere that was there, you know, it's a great and vivid description of what it's like, and then, you know, it's against the Soviet Union, and then there's also the tour to South America, which, you know, you talk about the players that I think 13 out of the 20 are the only ones that used, and 7 are never used. And it's, I mean, I can remember the tour because obviously you remember John Barnes's goal in the Maracanã, and obviously it's that tour that from that game. But do you find your England experiences a bittersweet, or does the pride at representing your country just override all of that?
It was bittersweet, but yeah, it does override it, because at the end of the day, I got what I wanted. I got my England cap, and dreaming as a kid from primary school onwards that one day I'd play A for my local team, Villa, and play for England, because that's what every kid did. You know, I want to play for the team that I support, and I want to go play for England. So yeah, it's bittersweet in some ways, but nobody can take them two caps away, and I wouldn't change anything.
And I've got to say, I love the sort of the title of the chapter about bringing him down, and you know, it's good to read that sort of refreshing honesty. And I guess any player can relate to it, whether it's Sunday League or the Premier League. You know, you always want to be in that starting 11, and then when someone's doing something brilliant, which John Barnes clearly did, and you want, as a teammate, you want to share in his glory and success, but ultimately you want him to just put it past the post, or you want him to fail. And I think it's great that you're not afraid to write that.
Yeah. Do you know, it happened on the far side of the pitch to the dugout. So I'm in the dugout. I think if you'd been on the near side, I might have run on and tripped him up.
And you know, again, Gary, obviously, you know, Bobby Robson's in charge at the time. You know, you have great admiration for Bobby Robson, but it does seem a strange concept to take 20 players to South America and have seven not take to the pitch in any way, shape or form.
It does, yeah. I mean, it does seem strange. And I guess perhaps there's that sort of similar situation to what Steve was mentioning earlier about if you're in the first team, if you're not in the first team, you know, you're invisible almost. Because from reading part of Steve's book, these guys were almost made to feel invisible, almost a group apart, not part of the main party, not part of the play. Players as such, almost like, you know, extra baggage, as it were. So it must have been a fairly, you know, why take six or seven guys to the other side of the world just to run about in training? I mean, it just seems a bit weird. I mean, you know, a counter argument, I suppose, is that, you know, it keeps them as part of the setup. But from what's, you know, Steve wrote in the book, that was hardly the case anyway.
You know, as we've talked about, I suppose maybe in some respects, you know, we sort of lament the changing of the game, we do, because we're quite old, but we sort of lament the changing of the game and how it's gone. But I guess you would like to think that sort of treatment possibly wouldn't happen quite so much now.
Yeah, it is an oddity to do that, you know, to take so many players on a South American tour. I think it was three games, and then not to kind of, like, you know, see everyone in action. I think he does a similar tour the following summer to Mexico and North America as acclimatised towards the 1986 World Cup. And I think he's a bit more expansive in the players that play in those games. So whether he learned from that mistake and took that into, you know, the following year, maybe he did. Within that, you know, perhaps, you know, Steve can lay claim to that, you know, he'd been part of maybe a hypothetical 1984 European Championship squad that England qualified for. You know, maybe that's a badge of honour that he can take from this. But yeah, you know, it is a shame that, you know, he and the other six didn't get a game out there. It does seem a bit incredulous.
Like I said, you know, I appreciate you've already taken up an awful lot of your time, Steve, and I could carry on talking to you for hours and hours. But I guess as we sort of come to the end of your career, and obviously there's that, I suppose, almost perfect symmetry, not in how it ends, unfortunately, but certainly that you end up back at Villa. And again, as a young lad, you know, and we've talked about it, sort of 17, it's everybody's dream to play for the boyhood club, then it's to play for England. You have this incredible career where you get to play with the best players in the world. I'm not saying was it always your intention, because there's no definites in football, but were you happy that your career did end at Villa, or Villa was the club that you were at when your career finished?
Yeah, I mean, as I said, I didn't really want to leave West Brom, but obviously Mr. Saunders, I mean, that was never going to happen. So to go back to the Villa was kind of the dream ending. I mean, I obviously didn't think it was going to be the ending, but and he did go eventually. Bittersweet, to be honest. When you think they'd won the European Cup not too long earlier than I joined, I wouldn't say they were in a mess, but they were certainly on decline. And although we avoided relegation first year, the second year was a disaster and we went down. So very bittersweet, but luckily they bounced straight back.
And again, someone, I mean, like I say, your career is just full of characters that you've come into contact with. And there's obviously a lot of chat about Doug Ellis and the way he ran Villa, you know, and maybe so much the lack of investment in that Villa squad that was broken up. And, you know, you talk about the fact that he wasn't there when they won the European Cup and whether there was some sort of statement of intent. But again, as a person, as a chairman, if you like, you know, how did you find Doug Ellis?
Well, I mean, obviously, you know Doug Ellis right from the beginning. I mean, I was at Villa Park training as a youth when he sacked Tommy Docherty. You know, I can go back that far as to knowing Doug. One thing I will say about him, he's claret and blue running through his veins. You know, he 100% Aston Villa. But I do think, particularly at that time, we needed far more investment into the team. And I think Graham Turner, who was the manager who brought me back, was trying to get, you know, some quality players in, and it didn't happen.
Yeah, and I guess same to you then, Gary. You know, like I say, you know, you were there front row at the Midlands. You know, can you sort of relate to what, you know, what Steve was saying about, you know, the breaking up of that Aston Villa side post-European Cup, the appointment of managers, how Doug Ellis either hired or fired his, you know, his managers and stuff? Is it, you know, as a fan of Villa, obviously, but as a football fan living in the Midlands, is that how you saw the club sort of being run as well?
Yeah, it absolutely is. Yeah, I mean, you know, the phrase "Deadly Doug," you know, is widely known and appreciated throughout the Midlands. And you know, every manager will say afterwards, you know, all I needed was two more players, and we could have been, you know, winning a trophy and that sort of thing. But certainly, you know, investment at the Villa, the purse strings at Villa were guarded like a Rottweiler by Mr. Ellis. And okay, and the other thing, you know, that is also was widely accepted or understood and is plain true was that Doug Ellis was Villa through and through. Absolutely no doubt about that. And, you know, I'm sure he thought he was doing the right thing. And, you know, as I say, managers will always want the two players, and, you know, we can get promoted or we can win a cup or whatever. But, you know, the last thing I'd do is club going to business through being bankrupt. And, you know, clubs have sort of peaks and troughs. And, you know, the period we're talking about now, Villa were going through that sort of decline period, and the aftermath, it was almost like the hangover from the European Cup lasted a few years, and the decline was pretty well set in by the period Steve's talking about. And, you know, I'm not sure two players would have made any difference. Perhaps they would, who knows? But, you know, Graham Turner was perhaps unfortunate that he went there at the wrong time, because when he went to Wolves afterwards, he performed miracles there.
And I guess, Stephen, you know, like we say, this is, you know, this whole podcast, the whole book, Steve's career, that, you know, played out like this movie. And just in case we didn't quite get this, well, we don't quite get the fairy tale ending, but it almost ends with this young player going back to his home club, and that's where the sort of story sort of finishes. But unfortunately, you know, as with some players, it's about, you know, it's about injury and the premature end of a career. But it's not a bad career.
Oh, it's a great career. You know, we buy this career, wouldn't we? Yeah. I'd definitely take New York. I'd definitely take Villa, Coventry, West Brom, a couple of England caps. I'd definitely have that. You know, if there's absolutely, you know, for us, you know, like I say, you know, this is the second edition of the Panini years, and you know, anything to do with that era for us is just fascinating. To Steve's had an incredible career, and, you know, nothing can take that away. You know, like you say, you know, take those two caps away, no one can take those years in New York away. You know, play for the club that he supported. You know, my God, you know, what things to have on your CV.
If I can just ask you one more question, Steve, and I'm just trying to work out how to word it. Do you see your career as having two potential pathways? So you either have the experience that you have in New York and playing with, and I know there's no certainties in football, but you have the career that you know you've had with Pelé and Beckenbauer, it's in New York, and then it's coming back. But on the flip side, on a slightly different fork in the road, is a league title and a European Cup. And, you know, granted, we know who the manager was and stuff there. But do you see your career as one or the other, or are you happy with the sort of taking the left path that took you to New York rather than the path that maybe could potentially have offered you a European Cup? But like we say, there's no guarantees.
No, 100% wouldn't change anything.
Great.
The experience I got, you know, just talking to you guys, I can hear the enthusiasm from you guys. To have that opportunity that I had, you know, yes, it would have been great to be part of a European Cup winning team and Division One, but I wouldn't have been the player that I turned out to be, or perhaps the person, more importantly, with that experience I had over there. So I wouldn't change it. I've just had a thought, by the way. I think we should push for a film for this book. And then I can get Steve as my replacement, my double. He's got the hair.
I'm on for this.
We can go to Warner Brothers. We've got an in at Warner Brothers. Surely we must be something there we can do.
Yeah, we can do this. I'm on for this.
Yeah, Stuart can be on the door at Studio 54.
Oh, yes, I can.
What do you want to be, Gary?
Gary, you can be the entire supporting cast of the Midlands.
You can come and play Ron Saunders.
Can I be Pillay?
Oh, dear.
Guys, it's just been a wonderful, wonderful podcast. It's just such a great way to spend a Tuesday. Gary, I'm guessing you're happy with... I am happy with Steve's answer that he chose the right career path.
Yeah, of course I am, matey. I just wanted say final thought. Can I have two final thoughts? One of the things we haven't touched on is what Steve mentioned about his coaching career and going through the FA coaching programme. And, you know, I remember when I did my coaching badges, I thought exactly the same thing as the Steve. And I thought, I remember that. Crazy. Charles Hughes' book, yeah, I remember that. Soccer tactics and training. I've still got it to you. You know, he uses to swat flies occasionally with Christian when up in the week. So, yeah, absolutely agree with that. All the things you said there, Steve, about the FA coaching programmes of those days was ridiculous. The other thing I was going to mention is, Steve, I wrote a novel not a while ago, and when you write a novel about football, try to keep it realistic. Now, if I'd have wrote your story, nobody would have considered that realistic, because, by God, you know, that's some career, buddy. So, you know, fantastic to have a chat with you, mate, and talk about that fantastic career.
Oh, pleasure.
Stephen, you enjoyed it. Looking forward to playing the part of Steve Hunt in the upcoming...
I'm looking forward to this. Now the location shooting in New York and you know, out in the Caribbean. So much looking forward to these recordings. It will be absolutely brilliant. One last question for Steve. You don't have a chocolate brown Coventry City away shirt still knocking around your wardrobe at all?
You just want to wear it in the film, don't you?
I think just to add authenticity.
I've got to say, Steve, like I say, it's been an absolute pleasure. The book's brilliant. The book, like I say, I just flew through it. The stories in it. Like I said, it's almost an unbelievable story, but it's not because there's pictures in it, so it must have happened. It's just the book's great, and like I said, the line "I'm with the cosmos" is just, I think it's fantastic. I'm still going to keep trying it and see what I can get with it. But it's been brilliant to chat to you. Absolutely brilliant.
Thank you. Guys, thanks for inviting me. It's been absolutely brilliant.
Oh, no problem at all. Thanks, Steve. You've been absolutely brilliant.
Yeah,
absolute joy.
I would love to get you back on just to chat some more about other stuff, especially and it's something else we haven't touched on as well, just quickly, really sorry, and about the mental health and the side effects and the impact of retirement, you know, what that's like for players and the support. There's so much that we've not had a chance to chat about, but yeah, I'd love to have you back on again if you've got another spare Tuesday afternoon in your locker.
Anytime, guys, anytime.
Brilliant. Oh, wonderful. Bless you. We'll hold you to that.
Gary, enjoyed it?
Brilliant. The missus has been out shopping, so I've sat here talking to my mates about football and with a guy who's had a career the like of nobody else. Amazing.
Stephen, same question, loved it.
Oh, stunning. You know, we can walk away from this saying that we've spoken to someone who played for Pele, played with Beckenbauer, Shinaglia, Carlos Alberto, Cruyff, the whole lot. Absolutely brilliant. Wonderful, a wonderful way to spend a Tuesday morning / early afternoon.
Yeah. It absolutely is. All that's left for me to say with a heavy heart, because I didn't really want it to end, is thank you for listening. And please join us again next time on the Lob podcast with These Football Times. Thank you and goodbye.
Many thanks for joining us today on the Lob, a These Football Times production. For more of our content, check out our award-winning print magazine featuring some of the game's foremost writers, artists and photographers, exploring areas of the game rarely covered in high-end print. For now, we look forward to you joining us again soon.